Akron, Ohio. This is episode 180 of On the Tropes. On this week's episode, we are talking about the trope signature style and our top five examples of signature style. But first, as always, I'm your host, Nick, and today I am joined by...
Simon.
And Kyle.
Signature style. So my summation of this, basically, is you put something on and you go, oh, hey, this must be...
So-and-so something.
Exactly. So there's something about it. What kind of things go into someone's signature style?
Depends on the medium, but the cool thing is that, as you said, the coolest thing about it is you can walk into a room and it's on the TV or a song's playing or there's a painting on the wall and you can say, oh, is this by X? Mm-hmm. And you can be right. And that's super cool. My favorite example of this is probably, I don't know if I have a favorite example, but a really cool example of this is that there is a band called Klaatu in the 60s and 70s, and people so desperately wanted the Beatles to be back together, and their style was kind of similar, that they're like, oh, this is definitely the Beatles, and they also kind of, like, vocally was very similar. So.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So it's just a band that sounded like the Beatles?
Yep, but... People desperately. I've always wanted to make a Beatles soundalike album, like the Redwalls were a Beatles tribute band, and you can hear the Beatles in some of their songs. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to YouTube or Spotify or download legally, thank you. It just sounds like it's a Beatles song.
That's cool.
It's really, really rad. Yeah.
This is like a weird tangent because I don't think that Coldplay is anything like the Beatles, but we were in a store yesterday and Charlie was with us and one of the Coldplay new songs was playing over the whole store and Charlie goes, she turns to us and is like, what's that noise? Like, yes, you got it.
That's awesome.
But yeah. I wanted a high fiver.
Yeah. So some similar tropes that this kind of overlaps with is one is signature shots. So in TV shows and movies, certain directors will have shots that they like to do, whether it's a tracking shot or a certain point of view shot. Like Tarantino likes the trunk shot.
Yeah. The doorbell. He always does the doorbell like profile too. Mm-hmm.
Creator thumbprint, which is like an item that recurs in people's movies. Iconic logo is another one, just the beginning of the movie.
Star Wars probably the best example of that. Or 007 with
And then author catchphrase is another one where it's not a catchphrase of a character per se, it's just something that is kind of littered throughout the same person's works.
Yeah.
And then I wrote down some things that can contribute to someone's signature style. So in terms of writing, like plot points or just like the type of story that it is.
Yeah. I got a couple of those.
So
for better and for worse too. Some of mine their style is obvious, but it's not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like they keep telling the same thing over and over again, it's not good. So it can be both a good thing and a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
This style is not necessarily a positive.
Yeah. The setting, like if people always do period pieces.
Dennis Lehane loves writing stories in Boston.
Yeah. Genre, so somebody who only does musicals could be considered their signature style. Visual style, not just in shots, but maybe in like color setting, or somebody always does something in like a gritty black and white or something like that.
Yeah,
like Marnell was always in black and white.
Mm.
that was like better joke than I got credit for.
Most black and white and always silent for reason. So yeah, there's a lot of things. I mean, I'm talking specifically about movies, but also, you know, yeah.
I mean, you're talking about plot with books too.
Yeah.
I have a couple writers.
I should say I have a couple writers here. Yeah.
And then what about video games? How does that?
I mostly did. So instead of, well, one of them, it's a creative director, but for the most part, it's studios, doing the same type of game or having a certain aspect to them. You'll watch a game and be like, that looks like it's either made by this company or definitely inspired by what this company did. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I got a few of those.
EA Sports has a recurring theme. Yeah.
EA Sports does. Yeah. Sports games.
They have some pretty good first-person shooters. You guys want to jump into our top fives?
Yeah, we could.
All right.
I thought this tape was going to be a conversation stimulator, man. I was going to ask you for your top five records to play on a Monday morning and all that, and you just had to ruin it. Hope we'll do it next Monday.
No! I'm going to do it now!
This is... I'm excited about my list. It's kind of like our mini, like, career...
Mm.
Yeah.
Retrospective totally. Episode.
Like two-line retrospective kind of. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Kyle, what's your number five?
My number five is a negative version of this, and I know I've mentioned her before, but it's kind of a weird mention because I've never actually read anything that she's written. I've just been married to someone who has and been with her for a long time, so I get to hear about these books. But Jodi Picoult, she's a very famous writer, but she has the same style where she always writes a story about a character that has some disease or something, and they ultimately, or at least for the, like, there was a common thread for a lot of her books where they would overcome this disease or something good would happen, and then the end of the book, that character would just die somehow. Like, it'd always have the downer ending, and you always could predict the loop, and Lisa was really into her for a while. Leah and Mom were too. And I think they all sort of dropped Jodi Picoult like a bad habit. Once they figured out the pattern. Yeah, that it's... She knows how to write the story really well, but she's also written the story several times over the course of several different books. So, this trope is cool in that it can be both a good thing and a bad thing. So, Thema, would be your number five?
I'm going to go with Stephen King. He's an author.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. His
Stephen King.
Stephen King.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stephen King.
Maybe it's Stephen. I'm not sure. But very frequently you're going to have blue-collar protagonist or family living their day-to-day life and then find themselves not through intention, but they find themselves in a situation where they're abutting the supernatural in some way. Very frequently you're going to have a character with an addiction issue. Very frequently you're going to be taking place in Maine somewhere.
Yeah.
And the East Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the endings very frequently don't... How am I going to put this? It's very realistic, in my opinion. It's not glorified,
they're kind of abrupt sometimes.
Yeah,
I do know it's funny with Stephen King in particular because he can write a 1,000-page novel, but then he can also write short stories. So yeah. It's like that's something that's like cool about him. But for his longer books, he does love to also write the backstories of characters that don't even need backstories. Like,
yeah.
He really has ideas for everybody, which is, I like sometimes.
Yeah, some of my favorite moments from The Stand deal with, like, oh, is this what's happening? There was a bunch of this happening. And he goes into these, like, tiny little, like, couple page vignettes.
Under the Dome was the same way, where he was writing about this entire town and going into the backstory of every single character in the entire town, it felt like. And I never finished that
in a
one.
Good way, or I guess not.
Yeah, well I've heard good things, and the show, I didn't think it was going to be that good, but I've heard mixed things. But he can write. It's just he's one of these writers you need to be in the mood, I think, sometimes to read his stuff. I've tried to read it, but just looking at that book kind of intimidates me.
It's that one I really dug.
I know a lot of people that really love it, but
the ending was weird.
Yeah.
It's hard.
I don't know. Like I when I think of it, I just think of like a killer clown. But the fact that it goes into just so much other stuff, and I'm like, wait, like unexpected.
Yeah,
it seems cool though.
Man, yeah, I didn't read Under the Dome, but I saw the Simpsons movie. Nick, you're number five.
That does take place on Under the Dome.
That's all you need to do.
My number five, I wrote a thing for What Culture where I ranked Guillermo del Toro's movies. So my number five is Guillermo del Toro, just because he's been on my mind and because I think he's a good director and a good writer. So a lot of his movies have fairy tale elements. His better movies, I think, are told from like a child's perspective. I think his two best movies are Pain's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone. Both of those are told through children's point of views. Both of those movies also take place during wartime, and a lot of his other movies also have wartime or post-war elements to them.
Cold War elements, yeah.
Yeah. Many of his movies have monsters and misfit characters. So Hellboy is like part... Is he part man, part demon?
Just demon.
Just demon. But he's man-ish.
Yeah, and he actually, I'll take him off, but I wanted to, that's the thing I love most about his style is that what he does is he humanizes the monster. They're fully fledged characters, and he has one of my favorite quotes, which is, "A good monster is a monster that you can imagine in repose." Mm. So, what is this guy doing when he's not terrifying people?
Yeah,
I just love his. Philosophy towards creature creation.
Yeah, so Hellboy is a demon, but he's the protagonist. He's a good guy. Mm. And Blade is a part vampire, part human, but he's the good guy. And a lot of his movies have ghosts in them, but they're not bad ghosts necessarily. Sometimes they're good ghosts, and the bad guys tend to be people who, usually men, who are in some kind of power position, either in the government or some kind of other institution. And those are the bad guys. Those are the villains, not these like creepy-looking creatures. Yeah. And
humans are the real monsters.
Yeah. And then Ron Perlman and Doug Jones.
Oh, and just applauding on both of those. You know, I wasn't thinking about, what is it? The vampire flick, his first big movie.
Kronos.
Like, that is such a beautiful example of, again, like a strong, strong movie. Child protagonist again in that one, and the bad guy is Ron Perlman, and the character, the protagonist is not only a kid but also a monster. Mm. Yeah, awesome. Yeah,
is the kid a monster in that? It's I haven't seen it in a few years, but
the grandpa's the monster.
And it's an interesting movie because it's
love stories with monsters. You could add that to the list.
Yeah, it's kind of like a vampire. I mean, it's ostensibly a vampire movie, but I don't think they ever use the word vampire in it.
I don't think so either. Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember.
It's an interesting movie. I don't love it. I think it's a little bit rough around the edges, but it's cool going back because it was one of his last movies that I saw. Going back and looking at it, having seen the rest of his catalog and going like, oh, this is where you like kind of started these ideas of monsters, and that one has a rich guy trying to, trying to use his station in life, and he's the bad guy. Kyle, what's your number four?
I keep going back and forth between what I want to include here, and I think I'll just go with what I originally had planned, and that's just the brewing company Thirsty Dog out of Akron. How they like to name some of their beers after dogs, which I thought was like just a cool thing. So they have like Old Leg Humper, which is a porter, Siberian Night, which is this Imperial Stout, and Cerberus, which is this Belgian Triple. I think they've been around. I don't know a lot about Thirsty Dog, which is kind of why I wanted to maybe keep this off my list. But I like breweries that do something like have themey things with their beers. I'm sure there are other ones around, but the fact that Thirsty Dog is out of Akron is kind of why I thought of them immediately. That would be your number four.
I'm gonna go with Maria Bamford. She is a stand-up comedian, and she revisits several things that I just love. One of them is, and she, one of the things is that she incorporates, she has this amazing talent for doing voices and modifying her voice.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So she can, and one of the major themes that she has is her family. So she can jump into like all of her different family members. And, so that's one of her,
it's like what she does for her dad. She always coughs.
Oh yeah. Yeah. and then she has like the slightest like tremble in her voice when she does her mom. She's just brilliant. She has two seasons of Lady Dynamite on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And if you've never seen the Maria Bamford show on YouTube, it's just brilliant. It's essentially the predecessor for Lady Dynamite, but it's just her playing every character. And her own anxiety and her openness, she's kind of a hero in that she's so open about her own struggle with, I think she has bipolar disorder. I don't know. She's brilliant, hilarious, and, incredibly talented. Yeah. Maria Bamford.
I love Maria Bamford. She is one of my favorite jokes of all time, which is, I'm a gypsy. I'm a sea cow. Yeah, I know the motorboats are going to hit me, but this is where I fucking swim.
I like her. She has a quote where it's like, she's talking about, a lot of people have different views on faith. I personally believe that God is a wizard in a tower that never lets me win. Number four.
I love Maria Bamford so much. My number four is, I think, the best living director right now. It's Martin Scorsese. He tends to do a lot of movies in the crime genre. He uses a lot of rock music in his movies. So
the use of stones.
Yeah, going back to his second movie, his first like non-student film was Mean Streets. He uses a lot of rock music in that. And then going through, you know, we've got Stones in a bunch of movies. We have Layla and Goodfellas. He has very good and sometimes really intricate tracking shots, like the Copacabana scene in Goodfellas, where they're walking through like the hallways. Mm-hmm. Taxi Driver has a very famous tracking shot towards the end where they basically like had to cut holes. They had to like destroy this building basically so that they could even do the tracking shot. He likes to do director cameos a lot.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it's quite every movie, but it's almost every movie. And a lot of times it will be him either playing a director or him with a camera. So like in Hugo, it's him operating a camera. I think in New York, he's a photographer. Or that might be The Aviator. But it's that type of role. He's often...
It's awesome.
Playing himself, kind of.
Yeah, playing a version that's quite nearly himself. And then a lot of his movies are about Catholicism and the guilt associated with being religious, like The Last Temptation of Christ or Mean Streets. Has a very famous shot of Harvey Keitel like sticking his hand just above a candle, like thinking about hell. And he uses the Madonna whore complex a lot, which is something that Freud, I don't know if he came up with or named, but it was something that Freud talked about. And it's basically you're splitting women into either like this perfect saint type character or, you cast them aside as a whore. Age of Innocence, I think, plays with that a decent amount, but it's probably most evident in his first movie, which is called Who's That Knocking at My Door? It's basically Harvey Keitel likes this girl, and then he finds out that she was raped and is no longer interested in her. So it's that's the most extreme example of it in his movies, lesser or more subtle examples. I think Raging Bull also does that trope very interestingly. So he has a lot of recurring themes in his movies. He's a great director,
and I love how he also did the Stones documentary too.
He does a lot of music documentaries. He's done the Stones, he's done the band, he's done Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm sure he's only doing stuff that he's like really passionate about too.
George Harrison.
Awesome.
Oh.
Yeah, he's done.
I had no idea he had a hand in that.
Yeah, he's done a lot of documentaries.
Yeah, when I saw that he was doing Hugo, I thought that was like such a strange move for him. I don't think I've ever watched it all the way through, but I've heard it's great.
It's good,
but yeah, it just seems really good. Like Goodfellas.
It's a kids' movie.
Goodfellas, Hugo.
Yeah, but Hugo's, it's a movie about loving movies, and
yeah.
I don't think anybody loves movies as much as Scorsese does.
Yeah, it's crazy.
What's your number three, Kyle?
My number three is just the company Media Molecule, who have been doing video games for PlayStation 3 and 4 for the last few years. Their big thing is that they like to make games where you not only play, but you can create in them and then share your creations. So in Little Big Planet, it's where they started for the most part. It's this two like side-scrolling platformer, but they have this creation engine in it, and so people can create their own levels, and there's a very high-tech like tech behind it all, and people have made like first-person shooters with that game. Like it's such a crazy engine. And then Tearaway is a game that was started on the Vita, and it takes advantage of the touch controls, and it uses the camera, and you'd like take a picture of your face, and your face is like the sun in the whole game, and they do really unique things like that. And their newest game called Dreams is basically just this really approachable game creation engine that everyone is losing their minds over. People started to like make games in it. They're about to release like a this beta version of it in a few months, but just how powerful it is, I just can't imagine what, when real game developers have their hands on it, what they can do. And I just love the fact that the games are exciting themselves, but the fact that the community can get a hold of it and do their own thing with it is really exciting too. So I just love how they approach gaming as a whole. So Media Molecule, they're a company that I've, now when I hear that they're working on something new, I'm always excited for it. So Thimo would be your number three.
I'm going to go with Ron Gilbert. This is a game maker, developer. He is with Double Fine. Before that, during the golden age of adventure games, he was with LucasArts. And he created this like manifesto for how to create an excellent adventure game, point-and-click adventure game. So if you've ever played Monkey Island or Maniac Mansion or Day of the Tentacle, those types of games, or the games that came after, things like even that he maybe wasn't necessarily in charge of, but he really has influenced how to make those types of games.
Did you play Thimbleweed Park?
Oh, yes. And okay. I loved it.
Yeah, because I remember that game was announced and shown off, I was like, this seems like a Thimo game. Like,
it absolutely was.
Like, the clown character is just, like, so strange and weird. But, yeah, the whole, like, I pretty much played that whole game with a guide because I was just like, I'm not going to figure this out. I just wanted to, like, experience it, and it was still really cool.
But, for sure.
But that's definitely, like, that game came out in 2017. It does not feel like a game, like a modern game.
Oh, no.
It has such an old feeling to it, but in a, like, an amazing way.
Yeah, they were able to capture the retro, like, stuff that you loved about the games without making it as cumbersome as the original.
Yeah, so, I guess they updated some things, but for the most part, it felt like those old school games.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And some of the stuff outside from like how to design the game, like just there's elements of humor, there's dark comedy, there's lateral thinking is a big part of how he wants, how he designed some puzzles. So grew up on his stuff, love it to this day. Ron Gilbert, Nick, your number three.
My number three. I was catching up with movies from last year before the Oscars, and I wanted to watch The Favorite by Yorgos Lanthimos. So I asked Nelly, hey, do you want to watch the new movie by the guy who made The Lobster and Dogtooth? And she said, absolutely not. So a few days later, we'd watched something else, and I'm scrolling through on iTunes, and I said, oh, we could watch this movie called The Favorite. And she saw it had Olivia Colman in it and Emma Stone in it, and she said, yeah, sure. So
you guys are no longer married.
So we start watching it, and you know, it's different than a lot of his movies. It's a period piece. It's taking place in England. But there's a scene where there's a dance, and I'm trying to pull up the video of it, but I can't find it. But anyways, there's a dance scene, and it's a very weird dance scene. She stops and turns to me, and she goes, is this from the fucking Lobster guy?
Nice.
I go, yep. That's,
what a great thing as far as this trope, though.
And I go, yep. And she goes, God damn it.
How far into the movie was it?
Like maybe 20 minutes.
Oh, no. Did she leave?
No, no. She ended up liking it, I think. So he has weird dance scenes in a lot of his movies. Dogtooth has a very strange dance scene in it. The Lobster has people dancing in the woods. This movie has a dance scene. There's dance scenes that bookend another movie of his called The Alps. So weird dance scenes, something he's into. He uses really weird filming techniques. So in Dogtooth, he frames it in a way that a lot of times people's heads aren't totally in the frame. And in this, he uses a fisheye lens for a lot of the movie, which is really jarring to see in a film.
Yeah. Mm.
As opposed to like a skateboarding shot or something like that. He often, not in this one, but in a lot of his other movies, he uses like what basically feels like a parallel universe. Like the Lobster isn't really our world, even though it has a lot of elements that are similar to our world. We can't turn people into animals, which is kind of the plot of that movie. He uses a lot of somewhere between shocking and awkward to upsetting sex scenes.
Yes.
And then maybe most strikingly is just his acting style. He uses a lot of really deadpan acting. I can't think of a better way to describe it, but if you've seen The Lobster, Colin Farrell and that doesn't emote much. And that's how most of this guy's movies are. I think The Favorite is maybe a little bit different in that there's more emoting. But, I mean, his two English language movies before that, The Lobster and Killing of a Sacred Deer, are very, like, expressionless. Mm-hmm. Everything's expressionless, even though lots of things worthy of expression are going on. So he's got a really, really unique, distinctive style. And yeah, just the dance scene tipped Nelly off and
nice.
Briefly enraged her.
I don't know why we didn't talk about the dancing guy in Twin Peaks for cringe comedy.
Well, that's not cringy.
it's a little weird.
It's up my alley.
Weird. But not, I don't know if it's comedic. It's just what is happening. The whole lodge scene.
Yeah.
Sometimes my arms bend back.
Kyle, what's your number two?
My number two is the first author that came to mind when this trope was being talked about, and that is Michael Crichton, who I've only read a couple of his books, but Jurassic Park and Micro both are very heavy on just, you can tell he's done a lot of research when writing, and Jurassic Park in particular, he'll go off on a tangent in a whole chapter of just talking about science and the science behind, like the fake science behind something that he's talking about in the movie or in the book. And it's just really fascinating. And I kind of like,
this is part of the dance scene.
Oh, jeez.
This is the dance part where Nelly was just like, is this?
That's ridiculous. But yeah, Michael Crichton is an author where you kind of need to be in the mood to read his stuff, but I do like these really, like, I feel smart when I'm reading his things, even though he's ultimately kind of talking about science that isn't real. Like in Micro, it's basically like an adult version of Honey, We Shrunk the Kids. So it's really like fascinating to read stuff that he has done a lot of work on. So Michael Crichton's my number two. What about you, Themo?
I have a tie, which I'm in unfamiliar territory here, but I figure why not. And it's for two artists. One is Bruce Timm, who's primarily known as a comic artist. But if you ever watch Batman, the animated series, they utilized his style for those characters. And you have a lot of straight lines, kind of exaggerated features, certainly. But in general, just and the thickness of the lines will vary, which provides like some interesting ways to contour and kind of show expression of these characters. And it's just within the comic world, you know, you have a lot of known artists, but his to me is probably the most unique. And that you don't see in a lot of others. Yeah. And then I guess you could say Alex Ross and Greg Capullo too, and of course Jim Lee, but in general, his are even, you know, more apart than that. And I would say the other person that I wanted to say as far as artists goes is going to be H.R. Giger. Could have done Van Gogh or you know. But
yeah, but what movie have they worked on?
Exactly. So there's something about a Giger work, even if it's not, you know, you're not looking at the alien from Aliens or from Alien even. You can tell that his hand had a part in creating it just be from the some themes of like number one, very often monochromatic. Number two, he uses like curves in a very particular way. And then you also have this merging of the biologic and the mechanical, and where do they meet, and which are you looking at? I've never seen another artist quite like that. So, yeah, Bruce Timm and H.R. Giger for my number two. Nick, your number two.
My number two is the Japanese director Yasujiro Ozu. So he did, I think most famously is the movie Tokyo Story, which is always up there in terms of one of the best films when people make lists of the best movies of all time. Most of his movies are about family dramas. They tend to be kind of like small, quiet stories. He uses the dramatic ellipsis a lot, which is a technique where he will just skip important events. So one of his movies is called Late Spring, and it's about a daughter who lives with her father, and she's going to get married, but she doesn't really want to. And the whole movie's building up to that, and it just skips her wedding. It doesn't show her wedding at all. It just goes from her about to be married, and then she's already been married. So he uses that a lot in his movies. Some other movies have like characters who die, and you don't see them die. It's just, it goes to, well, that person's dead now. His film technique, he does a couple things that are really interesting and a lot of people have taken from, but he was kind of the one who pioneered it. Instead of when he shoots conversations, instead of like over the shoulder shots, he puts the camera so it's head on. So he's facing like, it's like the camera's on a table in between the two people, and he shoots them so they're looking directly at the camera. And it's kind of weird. Like the first time I saw one of his movies, it was like, it made me feel uncomfortable almost, because the people are like in the center of the frame looking directly at you.
Yeah.
It's a little odd. And then he uses a shot called the tatami shot. So tatamis are like those mats in Japan that people will kneel on. Mm-hmm. So he has his camera is almost always totally still, and he'll shoot the camera from the like a low point of view. And it's supposed to be the point of view of somebody who is kneeling on one of those mats. So the camera will be pretty low to the ground. And then the other like filmic technique that he uses a lot is, instead of transitioning between scenes normally, he'll have a shot in between of like, if we were talking here and then a cut to us at the store later, in between those two shots, instead of just cutting directly, he would insert a 10-second shot of just like a tree in the wind or something like that. He likes to do that in between his transitions. He's just a really good, masterful director, and he has these strange camera techniques. Like his camera is almost always entirely still, and it's seems very, I don't know, disciplined, I guess. But a lot of people have taken from that, and it always feels reminiscent of his movies.
Yeah, I do that a lot too. I like to frame everything perfectly, so I don't need to move the camera at all. So it's almost like a painting that is moving.
That's a good description of his. He likes to shoot through like doorways and corridors a lot. I think a lot of people attribute that to Kubrick, but I think Kubrick probably got it from him. If I had to guess. Kyle, what's your number one?
My number one is just the best game developers right now, and that's Naughty Dog.
Thirsty Dog and Naughty Dog,
who have been
you have a signature style,
pushing like games ever since Crash Bandicoot. They wanted to make something back then that would compete with something like Mario, but Mario was always going left to right, so they wanted to go like into the screen. So they made Crash Bandicoot. Jak and Daxter is one of the best platforming series ever. Then with Uncharted and The Last of Us, and just really the introduction of Neil Druckmann as a creative director. He directs these games like movies. I've seen behind the scenes footage where he's directing scene now that everything's CG and they're all in mocap. He'll do the same scene over and over and over again just to get the right performances from his actors, and it's really amazing to see. These games are just so polished and so like well done, and they're always worth the wait. And whenever you hear the new thing that Naughty Dog is doing, like, you have to pay attention to it and have to be excited for it. So yeah, they're my number one signature style. Then what would be your number one?
Excuse me. My number one is going to be Philip K. Dick. If you haven't read him, check him out. Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It's probably and The Man in the High Castle are probably his two best known works. But science fiction author. And the thing that I love about his style is that it kind of merges kind of a philosophical, surreal blend with hard science fiction. So kind of the meeting of science and the soul. Very often in the ends of his works, there's this revelation about the truer nature of reality, often accompanied by like a character kind of coming in and saying, this is how it actually is. And then there's this epiphany moment. And it's, I don't know, the endings always get me. Like, even though I know it's coming, that something is going to be switched out, I'm always like kind of moved and taken by him.
Have you read Ubik?
No, I have it.
It's so good.
Is that when ice is taught how to not melt at, or not freeze at freezing point? Am I getting him confused with Vonnegut? Never mind. Forget anything I just said.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Vonnegut's another great one. Jeez Louise.
I think that is either Cat's Cradle or Breakfast of Champions. I read those
it's Cat's Cradle.
I read those back to back, and I get them confused. Yeah. No, Ubik is... It fits everything you were talking about perfectly.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite books of all time.
I'll read that
next. His books make some of the best movies that we have. I mean, Blade Runner...
Totally.
Is...
Scanner Darkly.
Minority Report.
Minority Report. Total Recall?
Total Recall? Yeah.
I mean, no, I know it was him. I just don't know if that's considered a good movie.
No, I'm going, yeah. Total Recall is actually, I mean, it's a little bit 80s, kind of over the top, campy.
Yeah.
If you've, I feel like it's a movie that a lot of people have seen. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty good summation of his work, like that style and the kind of twists and turns that it takes. I haven't read the book Total Recall.
But, I haven't.
And I think most people have probably seen Blade Runner. I would hope.
That is such... Man. I'm just taken by that and the sequel, both of them.
Yeah.
I'm just taken
You just by saw it. The sequel, right, recently? Or are you
about
just...
About a year ago.
Oh, okay. Because you brought it up a few times.
I just didn't
recently.
Because it's like the first one. It's a movie that has like, it still simmers in my like subconscious somewhere, where there's that weird meditative element, yet everything is so cynical at times and like, you know, but it's also meditative and there's this weird tranquility amongst this dystopian future. I just love it. Yeah.
I love Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
He's awesome.
Is there a good chance I could guess your number one?
Yes.
I don't know. Is it Miyazaki?
No, but I thought about putting him on here. I feel like I talk about Miyazaki a lot, but...
What happens when John types in Miyazaki?
Hayao.
Hayao.
No, I thought about putting him on here, and really the only reason I did is just because...
Yeah. I was trying to figure out a way to do, like, just Pixar in general, mm-hmm. but, their movies... There are definitely some stinkers for me, like...
Pixar?
Movies,
Miyazaki doesn't have any stinkers, and he's got a lot of... He's not on my list. We'll talk about it at some other time in the future, I'm sure. But
that'd be a heck of a person episode.
I would love to do that episode. We should do that episode. He's so good. But no, my number one is the director Wong Kar-wai.
Nice.
I mean, Chungking Express is my second favorite of his movies. Yeah. Fallen Angels.
Oh, yeah. He's older movies. Like
slightly. I mean, he's still making them now. But yeah. And his best is In the Mood for Love. But his movies tend to...
I heard that one's brutal.
In the Mood for Love?
Isn't that one brutal?
I mean, it may or may not be. he tends to focus on mood and atmosphere over conventional plot structures. A lot of his narratives are fragmented or bounce back and forth between characters, or Chungking Express and Fallen Angels both have... Like, Chungking Express, the whole first half of the movie is about one guy, and then the second half of the movie is about another guy. And they're not really that directly interrelated. And Fallen Angels is kind of similar. He has Tony Leung in most of his movies, who's a great... I think our greatest living actor right now, Tony Leung. And then he uses Christopher Doyle as his cinematographer for almost all of his movies, if not all of his movies. And he is... Well,
Christopher, he hasn't won us an award, Oscar.
It's because he makes movies with Wong Kar-wai, and the Oscars, as I've noted, are racist against Asian movies.
Yeah.
And between Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle, some of their like filmic techniques include lots of slow motion, off-center framing, really, really vivid, vibrant colors.
2046.
Yeah.
That was another movie that I did research on for a project at school.
Gorgeous movie.
Yeah.
And then he uses a thing called step printing. Did you guys do any of this in film school or not really?
You have to describe it.
So
probably not.
Step printing is film is usually shot at 24 frames per second. I assume that you can do this with digital, but I think it's something that at least started with.
Projecting it faster or something?
No, you duplicate frames. So instead of like frame one, frame two, you do frame one, frame one, frame one, frame two, frame two, frame two.
Just like slows it down.
It
like
gives it
artificial.
Yeah, slow. people say it gives it like a flip book appearance almost. And
it's
then
like jittery.
Yeah.
So you're not taking frames out. You're
adding frames.
Yeah. What I did sometimes, because we actually like cut film together on tables, I'd have something film and then I'd cut to like something real quick, like a flash frame or whatever, and then cut back. But yeah, nothing like that.
And then the last thing that I have for him is just that repetitive song use. So in Chungking Express, they use the song California Dreamin'. They probably play it 12 times in that movie. And In the Mood for Love does something similar. Fallen Angels does something similar. So it's just a technique that he really likes to use. But he's such a good filmmaker. He's really like one of the best working filmmakers that we have right now. And his movies are just... So here's a video of what step printing looks like.
Looks like loading.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a cool...
Nick doesn't know. That's actually
but
it's got this like sort of dreamy, stuttery.
Yeah, dreamy is a good way to describe it.
Quality to it.
Well, it's not playing because my internet's going.
Oh, yeah, and that's been iffy.
Going a little slow
in this windstorm.
Step printing.
Before
a joke
we
there somewhere.
Oh, no, I'm gonna look it up later.
Before we wrap up, since we've all written stuff or shot stuff, what do you guys think is your own signature style?
Oh, that's lovely. What a lovely question.
I mean, I said it earlier. I really like perfectly, not to like a Wes Anderson style, perfectly framed shots, but something where you can frame it in a way where if a character is moving or something, that you don't need to adjust your shot in order to make up for that.
Will you also just by, I don't know if you do this because you like the style or just due to necessity, but shoot handheld?
Yeah, that too. I'd like to get better with handheld stuff, but I like a good rack focus from shooting through something or like going from the foreground to the background without moving the camera. So
I was going to say that I know you like to use rack focus a lot, which is a technique that I like, and Wong Kar Wai actually uses a lot too. So rack focus is where you describe it, because you know better than me.
Yeah, basically you focus on something. I usually start, I guess it goes back and forth, but I usually start like something close up, like an object, and then I'll push back focus to the person or something in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And they start off the scene out of focus, and then they kind of switch. I did that a lot because I didn't like to pan the camera over, and that was a good way of adding motion to the shot without having to really move the camera. Mm-hmm. But I remember one of my first days at film school, I didn't know what was actually happening during a rack focus. I was like confused, and when one of my roommates told me about it, I was like, my mind was blown, where it's literally just changing the focus from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's cool. Something that I still try to do sometimes.
Yeah. I like that technique a lot.
Yeah.
I don't have I'm not a skilled photographer.
You like, you like writing things based on Pixie. Or like you like naming your movies after Pixie songs.
I do have that written down. I wrote some notes. I wrote titles equal song titles. Yeah. Most of the short films that I've written, all but I think two of
inner monologues.
Yeah, I do use some inner monologue. I'll tell you what I have written down for myself. So
black and white pictures.
I've written 9 completed, and then a couple that I've like started and.
That's awesome.
I don't know where they're going, but they're all relatively short. So I like writing short films. I like using movies or writing scripts with small casts, just because if we ever were to make them, I feel like that would be far more manageable.
Yeah.
Most of the things a lot of the like techniques that I write are based around like things that I think that we could actually do. So not a lot of special effects, nothing that requires like big dramatic acting. Like, 'cause I figure like when we shot part of a movie, like it was just our sister who doesn't act, so there was no like, she didn't have to cry or anything like that. There's no big over the top acting moment
for that movie in particular. We were just like, we just wanted to make it.
We didn't need like
it didn't need to be perfect. We didn't need to cast somebody or go to the perfect location. We were just like, oh, this looks like a nice place, let's just do something here.
Along those lines also, like, I don't ever write special effects or anything like that. Or like when I've written scenes of violence, it almost always happens off screen.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's easier. And then most of my things have either bittersweet endings or ambiguous endings where it should have one more scene after that to like wrap everything up. And I just cut that scene out. I don't want it.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, that's how I like my movies to end. I don't like a resolution. I like...
What was the movie you went to within the last year or so, and the person in the theater with you was just like...
What?
Yeah.
Like, oh, like, it was probably Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds familiar. Where it just ended so abruptly that, like...
It's not even abruptly. It's just a conventional movie would have one more thing to give you a little bit more...
Resolution.
Yeah, a little bit more satisfying of an ending. And this movie just, it ends right before that, so it doesn't answer quite every question, and it's so good. because it lets you do a little bit of the work. Like, you sat and watched this movie for a couple hours. You should be able to fill in the blanks.
Yeah. This is the McAvoy X-Men universe?
Yes.
Phoenix.
Got it.
Jean Grey.
Apparently it's Sansa, which... I don't know. I haven't seen any of the new ones.
I haven't either. What's your style, Themo? I ask.
I don't know.
Someone who's read a bunch of your things.
I don't know. You tell me, man.
Punny titles.
I do like to, like, one of my favorite things to do is...
Or, like, mashup genres, maybe.
I like to take, like, good movie titles, and then, like, depending on what the script is, alter it, like steal it a little bit. Like, My Dinner with Zombie, instead of My Dinner with Andre, and With Nails and Eyes, as another zombie movie.
The Fat Assassin.
Oh, yeah, Fat Assassin. I outlined that and I'm like, this is so stupid. This is so dumb. But I pictured it as like a hobo with a shotgun type thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think genre pieces I like.
I was going to say, I think everything you've written that I've read has been some form of either horror or sci-fi.
For sure. Yeah. Horror, sci-fi. I think the lone exception of that is going to be when I try to do my own celebration of nerd culture, which was it wasn't a good script, but it was fun to try to write a full-length script. The nerd party
one. Yeah, that had genre elements to it, though.
For sure. I mean, like, that was that, like, they're exploring genres throughout that thing. You're right. Man, yeah. I should revisit that and try to make it, like, palatable.
Yeah. The next script I'm going to work on is definitely going to be the Babe Ruth. Having been twins.
Oh my god.
wait, what was that again?
This Babe Ruth was actually twins.
Bad.
I'm digging my cyberpunk thing right now. I'm digging that a lot.
For the radio play?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that
the listeners might get to enjoy someday.
Yeah. Just scripts that we could just produce on here instead of like having to shoot something and take a year to make a 5-minute movie or something.
Did we ever release that one episode of that show, like The Pitch or whatever, where we come up with ideas?
Oh, I think things. We did, and then we never followed up on it. Oh. Kind of like how we've never followed up on The Shames, which I still want to do. Yeah. I think I'm just going to like incorporate my shame movies into my list because I know I've talked about Cool Hand Luke on a list.
Yeah.
So I just have to incorporate the other two at some point.
I just need to see Schindler's List. I have to gear myself up for it.
Yeah, you do. Anyways.
Yeah. Anyway.
Maybe coming down the pike. Who knows?
Pike or pipe?
Pipe, right?
Pipe?
Yeah.
I think so.
All right. Whatever. Calm down. If you guys have signature styles that you want to tell us about, you can let us know at onthetropes@gmail.com, facebook.com/onthetropes, or over on Twitter. You can learn more about the trope at tvtropes.org. You can give us your money at patreon.com/onthetropes, and you can use your money to get stuff instead of just giving it and getting, I mean, not much in return, really, at redbubble.com/people/onthetropes. You can buy a bag or a cell phone case.
Stickers.
I bought the stickers. I don't know where I put them. I think they're somewhere in, like, my computer bag.
Do we have hats?
We don't, unfortunately.
Oh, that'd be sweet.
I think you can get a pillow. That would be cool.
Oh, boy.
A pillow?
Who?
That would be...
Like a square pillow, like a couch? I don't know what they're called.
I was picturing like a body pillow.
Picturing like a pillow that one of our fans would sleep on every night.
No, I think like one of those...
yeah.
Like a square pillow that you like put on the edge of a couch.
We could design pillows with each of our faces on.
That'd be awesome.
Nope.
No? You're not in on this?
I don't think so.
What about those pillows with the sequins on and you like push it down and it's one color and you push it up it's a different color?
Charlie has one of those.
What if there was one where like you push it down and it's Kyle and then you push it up and it's me?
And it's really the exact same thing.
Then you flip it over and it's Sir and I.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
If someone knows how to make those... And
send us a prototype.
And wants to do the creepiest thing that I've ever thought of. Please let us know. if you want to give me nightmares for my whole life.
Now, the creepiest thing would be when they send it in, and no matter what side or which direction, it's just your face.
No, it'd be creepy if you did like half and half. Like you have half the sequence is like your face and half the sequence is Sir's face. So it's like a two-faced type thing. Yeah, there's a lot of creepy things we could do with this. Please don't, listeners, please don't do this.
Yeah.
We don't want to see it. yeah, anyways, I've been Nick.
Thumbo.
And Kyle.
Join us again next week when we'll be stuck.
Are you doing that technique?
The stutter?
The
whatever
cut. The step printing?
Yeah.
Printing.
Yeah.
Step printing.
On. The. Tropes.
Outro. I love Wong Kar-wai so much. He's so good.
I need to check out his stuff.